Welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker with my guest host, Andy Lowe. Andy, how you doing today?
John, I'm hanging in. Doing well, my friend. How are you?
I'm doing well. I've got some good guests in today that I'm excited to talk to. These guys are kind of coming from my side of the business, so I've got lots of great questions for them. Biz Rocket Radio, as you all know, is an opportunity for us to chat with executives and business owners and learn about some of the challenges that they've gone through and some of the successes that they've had and kind of share that with our audience. Today, two of our guests are with Bob Terry and Pat Huddleston, which are partners at Page Perry LLC, right?
Right.
That late. And I want to welcome you guys in.
Thanks.
It's great to be here.
So, Bob, maybe you could tell us a little bit of background on yourself and maybe kind of start in with the company.
Well, Page Perry is a law firm in Atlanta. We have, I guess, 11 lawyers now. We specialize in representing people involved in all aspects of the investment industry, both investors who may have a complaint or a grievance against someone they've been working with, but also industry members as well who are trying to make sure they stay in compliance with the myriad laws and regulations that that govern the investment industry. Before coming to Page Perry, I've worn a number of hats in the investment industry, everything from being a chief compliance officer at a broker-dealer to being Georgia's principal securities regulator for about 8.5 years. So, seen the industry from a lot of different vantage points.
Lots of angles.
That's right. Yeah, and there are a lot of angles in the investment industry.
We were talking about looking under the hood earlier before we got on the air, so lots of interesting stories, I would imagine.
I think we'll hear some today.
All right. Well, good. Pat, maybe a little background on you.
Well, I got into the industry through the Securities and Exchange Commission. In 1990, I started there as an enforcement attorney, and then a couple years later became an enforcement branch chief, which means I just got to lead a team of enforcement attorneys, investigations all over the country. Left the commission in 96 to go back into private practice, representing investors, and through that work, managed to get appointed as a receiver in some SEC fraud cases. So I'm the guy that gets to bring all the fun to an end. When the court orders place closed and a receiver appointed, I get to sit down in the chair of the scam artist and read his emails and try to find the assets. But in 2006, my experience with investors led me to found Investors Watchdog LLC. And my goal really was to put my law firm out of business. I was trying to keep people from falling victim to scams before they lost the money. And so I just had the experience many times of looking at the documents that they had in front of them and thinking, oh, man, if you had just come to me first,
yeah,
we could have saved you.
Yeah, so we're going to learn a lot about those kinds of things and share that with our audience. I'm excited to hear about that. Our next guest is Keith Green, and Keith is also an entrepreneur and has started up a couple of things that he's working on, also in the securities field, kind of working with advisors to try and provide opportunities for people to network and also learn a lot on the things that Bob talked about, all the regulations that are going on and compliance and you know, good practice management. So, Keith, welcome in.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about your background and how you got going with what you're currently involved in.
No, absolutely. My entire background has been in the financial services area. Started out actually as a stockbroker at Payne Webber, which later became UBS. And my focus has really been on retirement planning and retirement strategy with TIAA CREF and then later ING. I headed up strategy for a time with the Americas. I headed up various marketing groups and then ultimately government relations for the U.S. business, all with a focus on retirement planning, retirement products, and managing field distribution who sold retirement products. When I left ING, I founded the American Retirement Initiative, which is really a national discussion that's focused on retirement planning and how to help people retire better. We've had a couple summits where we have CEOs of financial services companies, but also SEC commissioners, folks from FINRA, Department of Labor, nonprofit think tanks, AARP, all with a common objective as to how to help folks plan better to retire better. Our focus is on advisors. human resources advisors, financial advisors, people who impact the decisions that millions of Americans make as it relates to retirement.
And clearly, we've had a lot of changes here in the last few years with the financial markets and the economy kind of going into the skids in 08, and certainly had some troubles in the early 2000s. But it seems like people feel a little frustrated with where they are from a financial independence standpoint, and they feel like really they got to push back what they've always been planning for from a retirement perspective. Have you found that to be the case? I mean, Keith, you probably see it all the time.
Absolutely. I find that absolutely to be true. A new study by Merrill Lynch suggested that about 71% of us now expect to or hope to work into our retirement years. I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is that people today are, say, better educated than their parents, are generally healthier than their parents, so in many instances are able to work. But beneath that, there's a lot of anxiety because the overwhelming majority of folks don't feel that they're prepared to retire. So a lot of the work is not because you just want to work, but because it's absolutely necessary, not only because of the Great Recession, but about but really the consumption and of all the years previously to that. People haven't saved enough. And the real issue is that the responsibilities that folks have right now are dramatically different than their parents. You're much less likely to have defined benefit plans. And not only do you have to focus on the whole accumulation piece, saving enough to retire, but the real issue now that's starting to get a lot of attention is how do you distribute it? Mentally, is your capacity the same at 80 as it was at 60 when you still have to make financial decisions? First, do you know what you need to know from the very beginning? But then, as time goes on, cognitively, are you able to continue to make the same decisions that you need to make over a lifetime?
And I can't help but think about how that impacts where Bob and Pat are coming into play with. You've got market conditions that are 2%, you know, CDs at 1%, less than that on money markets. There's no current income. Isn't that just a haven for people that are a little bit unscrupulous to take advantage of people that are really desperate to get those returns?
Well, it is, and we see it all day, every day. People have been conditioned over their maybe early adulthood to expect that there is a return out there that you can get that approaches double digits,
right,
safely,
right?
But it's not out there anymore, right. And they tend to forget the element of risk and start chasing that higher return. And when there are people out there who are willing to tell them that it's a safe bet, they say, hey, well, you know, 7-8%, it's not promising me the moon. It's not saying it's going to double my money in 90 days. It must not be a scam, right? Because that's what we've all learned. That's how you identify one.
Right.
I warn people all the time. A lot of the scams that I blog on now at Investors Watch Blog are promising single digits per year. No competent scam artist is going to promise you something that sounds too good to be true. The guys who do that flunked out of scam school.
Right. They're like, it's too good to be true, and people check into it way too much.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And so, but Keith has really put his finger on something very important, the cognitive decline.
Right.
I think the stats are 35% of people over the age of 71 suffer from mild cognitive impairment, which affects your judgment, makes you impulsive. And so even as people are working long past that age now, this is just a big problem that the industry needs to get its hands around.
I think there's also some evidence to indicate that the first, and arising out of some of these same studies, is that one of the first things that tends to disappear with the increase of cognitive impairment is the ability to not believe someone. Your trust level rises when, if you're investing in some of these off-the-books investments, your trust level needs to go way, way down.
Right.
You simply cannot suspend disbelief if you are involved in investing. You have to question everything, and that is the first trait that tends to disappear as people begin to age.
You know, Bernie Madoff is the big kind of name that's thrown out there as the fraud, right? But how many more smaller fish do you see that really impact a much larger population and maybe more of the mainline population?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're everywhere. They're small fish, they're big fish, they're fish that don't even appear to be fish, who are involved primarily in criminal enterprises to rip people off. And they can occur in the most unexpected places. Many of the worst scams that we have seen, for example, arise out of churches and
really?
Other places of worship. Affinity fraud is a term that's used frequently, meaning that scamsters find it very, very effective to try to affiliate with a certain group and then go after the people in that group because, again, that increases the level of trust. And it's a shame, but it's true. People have to be wary no matter where they learn of potential investments.
There was an interesting article, I think, in Money Magazine about that very thing, about how the odds are much greater, for whatever reason, that a scam is more likely to be perpetrated in somewhere like a church where trust is implicit.
Mm-hmm. Do you have examples, just so our listeners can kind of get a feel for how it might go down?
Well, for example, there was a very, very large scam that operated out of Tampa, Florida, several years ago, the Florida and Alabama Securities Commissions were very active in quashing. A group of people started a so-called ministry in Tampa, began raising hundreds of millions of dollars in that from thousands and thousands of people. And finally, when this scam was busted, the FBI and other governmental authorities raided the location of this operation and found millions of dollars of cash in storerooms just thrown into boxes in the back rooms of this operation.
Oh my God.
But the people who were operating this had been able to convince people that they were trustworthy and that they were doing appropriate religious affiliated work. So people gave them their money and never saw it again.
I think a really important thing to put your finger on is the thought that everybody who hears this is going to have when they first hear Bob tell that story. And
right.
That is, you know, thank God I'm not gullible enough to fall for something like that.
Yeah.
We all have these cognitive biases, one of which is the optimism bias, which when we hear a story of investment fraud leads us to believe that we're too savvy or sensible to fall for it.
Yeah.
Well, that is the product of a cognitive bias, the hardwiring that every healthy human has. It's not true, but we all tend to believe it. It's a coping mechanism that comes with every healthy brain. The CIA actually studies this and teaches their analysts how to overcome the effect of those cognitive biases. And so what I tell people is if fraud is what you want to avoid, fraud is what you have to look for. People tend to go out and seek evidence of legitimacy.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of it to be found, you know, either true or not true.
Yeah.
But if you're not looking for fraud, you won't find a fraud. And as to how often it happens, I blog on a new one every single day and usually have to choose from among half a dozen that have broken in the previous 24 hours.
You don't hear as much about it, right, on the general news. You just don't find that it's out there quite as much, but clearly not the case.
No, you could write about it as often as you could write about a story of someone going 75 in a 65-mile-an-hour zone. That's how often it happens.
Yeah.
And that's why it's not news.
Yeah.
Unless it takes a huge amount of money like Madoff, or in the local news, unless it rips off a local congregation,
right.
It's not going to be widely known.
Well, let me ask you guys this question. When it comes to some of this fraud stuff, what do you see more of? And I'm going to classify it this way, and maybe you can tell me if it works a little different. I'm thinking of front-end fraud versus a back-end fraud. A front-end fraud being something where somebody sets out with the intention of setting something up, and the idea is to rip somebody off. And a back-end fraud being it's a legitimate operation, it's a legitimate entity, and everything maybe on the front end is set up to be what it's supposed to be. But the deception and the deceit is on the backside, somebody, you know, kind of siphoning money off the back. I mean, I'm going to throw a fire out here and say, you know, a lot of government is showing up this way, city and local governments, for example. I mean, the entity was set up with great purpose and integrity, but you've got somebody unscrupulous in the government who is doing things with the money on the back end. So there's no reason for people not to trust them up front. But on the back end, things are happening beyond our control and people are getting ripped off. I mean, what do you see more of between those two?
I would think certainly the back end. I managed, you know, for a while, a lot of folks who invested retirement products for individuals, and you have people who have been in their careers for 20, for 30 years or more, and something will happen. They want to retire sooner rather than later. It wasn't something that they intended. Because someone may have, over the years, not made great investment choices, they really want to believe that there's this miracle investment. You're right, we're automatically optimistic. But additionally, when you're not as prepared as you'd like to be, you're even more predisposed to wanting to hear about that 12%, 15% guaranteed rate of return. I've had instances where in my sort of responsibility as a compliance, as a, you know, the sort of the OSJ or the person who has to read the various things that come in and sign off on it, you look at a signature and you go, that's not a signature. And you go back and you look and you go, you know, that's not right. And you have these heartbreaking conversations where you call the guy, and not a bad person, really, and say, you know, can you explain this to me? And I'll go, well, you know, it really wasn't a big deal. It was just this time. A person who'd operate it with integrity, we think, over, you know, 20, 30-year period. I think it's much easier to slide into something. And I'm wondering if you guys agree with that.
No, that's absolutely right. I give speeches all over the country about this, and I tell people more than 50% of Ponzi schemes start out as legitimate businesses.
Yeah.
And because of a life event, a need for cash,
yep.
You know, just that one small temptation. I tell people.
You kind of slide into it almost.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I ask people in the audience, you know, how many of you had a report card that you didn't want to show to mom or dad? And at least one other person besides me will raise their hand. And I say, listen, this is human natural temptation. We want to avoid the consequences of poor performance. So when an investment advisor is about to send out a statement that shows he lost a lot of money for people, he has that same fear that a middle high student does, and he thinks about the same remedy that the kid does. That is, if with one pencil stroke, I could make this D into a B.
Uh-huh.
And he sends out a phony statement, convinced that everything's going to turn around and he'll be able to smooth it all out next time.
Yeah, yeah.
More than half Ponzi schemes are started by people who, when they started into business, had every intention of being by the book.
So how do you protect yourself against that? I get how to protect. I mean, just don't be stupid. You can protect yourself against front end, right? I mean, you know, use a little due diligence. But this back end stuff, I mean, when it started off legitimate, how in the world do you position yourself to protect against that type of fraud?
Well, you have to understand that you've got a monitoring responsibility as you go along. So the statement you get from the investment advisor, you have to compare against the closing prices of the stocks that you supposedly own, because oftentimes you can find a fraud in that. I tell people, you don't have to think that the whole world is out to get you, but you just have to realize that your investment advisor is a human being with normal temptations and normal life events that is going to do what humans do best, and that's make mistakes. And so you've got to constantly monitor just to check up, because listen, you recovering afterwards is really hard. Now Bob can tell us, you know, how often do people get back 100%, 100 cents on the dollar, Bob?
Well, never. Once there's a scam, you never get back 100%, or almost never. I've never heard of a situation. We had a case a number of years ago in Georgia where we were actually able to return about 80% to people in a scam who were victimized in a scam. By the way, the average age of the victim was over 80 years old.
Wow.
In that case. We got over 80%, but that's only because we found out about the scam within the first 2 months of its operation and were able to go in and freeze the bank accounts before the money was wired offshore or spent on luxury cars or, frittered away in some other way.
And how often do you find out something that soon?
Very seldom.
Never.
Very seldom. Yeah. Let me mention one thing about that, too. The way we found out about that scam was a Better Business Bureau office in a small town in Georgia got a marketing brochure from this scam, which was purported to be an international investment company of some sort, and had the presence of mind to immediately call me and send it to me. There are so many scams that could be stopped in their tracks if someone who just has a hint, just an indication that something is wrong early on, would go to a state or federal securities regulator and say, you know what, I don't think something looks quite right about this. Maybe you need to look into it. So many of these scams get their energy because they were able to operate for weeks and months and even years before anyone just picks up the phone and calls someone and lets them know about it.
Yeah, amen to that. I actually wrote a book called The Vigilant Investor where I'm trying to empower people to make that call that Bob is talking about, because otherwise the SEC won't find out about this until it happens to stumble on it in an examination, or more than likely when all the money has been spent and checks start to bounce. And by that time, you'll be lucky to get a nickel on the dollar back.
So when you're looking at kind of protecting yourself, what are some of the maybe two or three top things that you would suggest to people on the investment front? Not necessarily the religious or you know, something where you're going into a church and they're just front end kind of scamming you, but on the investment side, on handling your investment resources and assets, what should people be doing to help protect themselves?
I think if you have an advisor who is evasive with answering questions, professional advisors should be very upfront, very open to answering questions. And if the questions you ask are hard questions, where can I back this up? What information do you have that supports what you're telling me? They should be very forthcoming with that.
Right.
If someone is doing something legitimately, they should not be concerned that a customer or a client is trying to go behind them and do their own due diligence.
Right.
Yeah.
And I don't think that fraud is what the typical investor generally encounters as much. It's fraud isn't a black or white thing. Many times there's that gray area that's in between. I think the best thing that you could do, or an individual could do, is just know as much as you can. Understand what you have. Understand the fee structure. Understand the terms and conditions of the contract that you have. And when something varies from that or deviates from that in some way, then your antenna should go up. But I think it's rarely, well, maybe not rarely, but it doesn't happen as often or the majority of the time. I think it tends to be something that's very gray, mm-hmm. that simply understanding what you own can solve a great deal of the time.
Yeah, great, great responses. I would add to those that you ought to check and make sure that your advisor is properly licensed. I tell folks, listen, we could probably cut out 20% of all investment fraud losses if we could just train people to call their state securities commissioner and find out if the person trying to sell them something is licensed to sell investments. And right. You know why. There are hundreds of advisors who are kicked out of the industry every year for violating ethical rules. Well, they don't go back to school to become dental hygienists. They keep doing what they've always done, selling investments. Illegally now, they've got the same sales skill, they've got the same charisma, same presence, but now they're doing it illegally, and people never think to check. So if you call up and you find out this person doesn't have a license, stay on the phone with the securities commissioner and say, hey, I've got somebody who's selling without a license.
And sometimes they will even use old letterhead, old business cards, old logos from their previous employer. We've seen that a number of times.
Now, doesn't FINRA and the SEC kind of track those people that have kind of been kicked out and say, hey, you know, let's make sure these guys aren't kind of dipping their toes back in the water?
Not really. No, they just don't have the resources to do that.
They don't have the resources. When you talk to a FINRA official or an SEC official, within the first few minutes, they're going to complain about the lack of resources. They're just not funded in a way that they could really do a lot of robust monitoring and enforcing.
And those people are very, very dangerous. I mean, if they had the resources and could track those people, they would get a huge return on it, because that happens a lot.
Yeah.
But they don't have enough to handle all the problems that are out there now, much less keeping up with people who've already been kicked out.
Yeah. When someone is kicked out of the industry, typically they intentionally just disappear into the woodwork for a while.
Right.
And lay low until the heat has passed.
Yeah.
But then they reemerge, often in a different city, different state, but start doing the same old thing that they were doing before.
And they have no, and now they have absolutely no guidelines or anything to follow through with, because their licenses are gone, and it's a heck of a lot easier to operate with no licenses.
They're off the radar screen.
Yeah, right. No examiner's going to come in to do an exam of them. Nobody's watching them.
Okay, so let's a couple of specifics. Where can people check to make sure individuals are licensed? Do you have a website or someplace that someone can go?
Well, no, the best place to go is to your state securities commissioner. People will hear to go to FINRA. You can get a free broker check through FINRA, but that is woefully incomplete, I will tell you. The New York Times has actually written about this. Better place to go is your state securities commissioner. Okay. Ask for a document called the CRD, mm-hmm. which stands for Central Registration Depository.
Yep.
It'll give you more information about prior employment, what they made on their licensing exams, any disciplinary actions, that kind of thing. That's the first place I tell people to go.
Now you can just call, or is there a website that they go to?
It differs by state. We oftentimes, when we do research on people, we get ours from the Florida Secretary of State's office, which is very responsive. We usually ask for it by email. I don't know whether the general public can do that, but at the very least, pick up the phone, and they'll send you one. Sometimes it's free, sometimes it's a buck or two, but it's certainly well worth the effort.
Right.
And, yeah, if you call just 911, you're going to get the number, mm-hmm. because that's...
411?
Yeah.
911. 411.
Call the police. Call the police. I need to check on my broker.
Yeah. Because it's a state agency. You know. Yeah.
So if I'm interviewing advisors, if I'm interviewing somebody that's going to be dealing with my money or dealing with that kind of a thing, what are some really good questions to ask that can... Those tough questions, Bob, that you mentioned, what would some of those tough questions be?
I think, obviously you want to find out about the advisor's experience, what their education is, their background, how long they've been in the business, what their typical type of client is. Are you the same type of client that they are dealing with on a day-to-day basis? But you also want to find out if they've ever had any disciplinary incidents. Ask the question, have you ever been disciplined? And if they tell you no, then you can check up on that by looking at the CRD report that Pat just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you want to find out where your money is going to be. It's an issue called custody.
Right.
Right. You never want to write your check to the financial advisor directly. You always want to work through someone who has an independent third-party custodian of your assets, because that means that they can't as easily put their hands on your money.
That's another big warning sign, too. You asked about warning signs earlier. If an advisor ever asks you to write a check to him personally, that's a huge red flag. Yeah. Run, don't walk out of that office.
Take your checkbook and heels to the door, right? Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at that same process of interviewing those advisors and trying to find out what kind of things that they're doing, and they answer all the right questions, and they have everything that's set up the right way, and they're using a third-party custodian, as it were, is it important to have multiple custodians? Is it important to have something at, let's say, Schwab and something at TD Ameritrade and something at Fidelity and someplace somewhere else? Does it give them any more protection to have that?
I don't know. What do you think, Keith? I can't say that I can speak to that.
Well, theoretically, it's sort of like going to a bank and having over the $100,000 FDIC threshold. To some degree, some diversification is a good thing. But if you're dealing with, and the majority of the time you are, an ethical, honest person, then you ought to be fine.
That's true. But you have to check up. There's one case that's in my book where a guy thought that he was dealing with a registered investment advisor, and the guy said, hey, look, I don't have custody of your assets. I'm going to set up an account for you at Charles Schwab, and you'll get your statements, and you'll see what's in your account. Well, he was out of town one day and wanted to check on the balance of his account, went to the local Schwab office, which had never heard of him, didn't have an account for him.
Really?
The advisor had just told him there was a Schwab account and there wasn't one. So is against your instinct as it is, what I tell people is, listen, you have to look for fraud if you want to avoid fraud. Just remember, they're human. The bad guy is not going to wear a black hat and have scary music play when he enters the room. He's going to look like the face you shave every morning.
Right.
All right. You've got to do these checks, or because the consequences are just too dire.
Talk a little bit about the blog that you have and the organization that you set up to kind of help people protect themselves against this.
Right, Investors Watchdog. The best thing we do is that we will review what people have received in advance of an investment. Usually these are unregistered investments, a limited partnership, a hedge fund, a private equity deal, something like that. And we'll go and do the kind of investigation that we typically do into the people involved. You'd be surprised how often we find that people are operating under assumed names, who have a criminal past, haven't disclosed everything. And then we write that all up in a report, and we say, listen, we can't tell you whether this is going to go up 20% or down 20%. Our job is to tell you whether it's a legitimate attempt to earn money, whether how much at risk are you from intentional misconduct here. Mm-hmm. And so the blog that I do is just the, sort of the free version of that. I write about a new investment scam every weekday, and usually it takes the form of an introductory paragraph, a couple paragraphs from a news story, and then I say, notice a couple things about this case. Here's how you could have avoided this one. And I tell people it's very important to read those things, because if you read stories about scams, you think that you've forgotten them. 30 minutes later, you can't tell me anybody who was in the story. But you know what? It stays in your brain. And if 5 years from now, you're looking at something that you think is legitimate, but it was similar to something you read 5 years ago, your brain, your fantastic brain, will send you a warning signal. Those neurotransmitters will fire. You'll get a vague discomfort in the back of your head that you can't quite shake. It's your brain trying to tell you there's something, you know something here.
Yeah.
Be very careful. But if you don't read these stories, there's nothing for your brain to compare it to.
And you're posting that on a daily basis.
You're posting
those examples on a daily basis.
Every single day. Yeah, Investors Watch blog is where you go to take a look at it. And we've been doing it for 4 years now. And so what I tell people is, you know, what we do, there's nothing odd about it. We're not clairvoyant. It's just that we've been swimming in this ocean for more than 20 years.
Yeah.
Several investment scams every single day. And that experience teaches you, gives you instincts that can really save people. We've helped save people millions of dollars that otherwise would have just been gone.
Vanished, yeah.
Yeah.
And Bob, maybe you could tell us a little bit about Paige Perry and the kind of people that you guys are working with on a professional level. You mentioned investors, also advisors. Who is your clientele?
Well, we have, as I mentioned, and you mentioned, investors who have been taken advantage of in one fashion or another, usually by, unfortunately, registered professionals. There are thousands and thousands of licensed securities brokers and investment advisors, and the 99.9% of those are professional, honest, hardworking, ethical people, but there is a very, just like every barrel of apples, there's a bad apple in every barrel. And we represent investors in some of those cases. Also, we represent a number of investment advisors and broker-dealers who are the registered professionals who are interested in ensuring that they conduct their businesses on an ethical basis in compliance with all the federal and state securities laws. It really is a minefield for people who are operating in the industry. The laws and regulations are set up to protect investors, but some of them have some very strenuous provisions that need a lot of effort and interpretation to make sure that you comply with them.
You will never be out of business.
Well, we hope not.
I'm just telling you, you are absolutely correct. And it gets more complicated every day, doesn't it? I mean, it just seems to get more and more difficult to interpret and understand what is the letter of the law and what they're trying to say with these regulations.
It does. The pendulum only swings in one direction for regulation. There are always more regulations. Very seldom are there fewer regulations. And you know, every few years, Congress will pass a new huge law like it did last year with the Dodd-Frank Securities Act, which brings a whole new level of regulatory oversight to the industry.
Yeah, it's daunting, certainly, but there to help protect that investor and try and weed out the nonsense that's going on with the fraud.
That's exactly right. That's the purpose of the securities laws, is to protect investors.
People may have heard about crowdfunding, something that came on with the Jobs Act, I think, and so the rules about how you can raise money from the public are always changing, and changing in a big way lately. And so that's one of the things that attracted me to Paige Perry, is having people like Bob, who've been the head regulator for a whole state, who stay up on these things. So if you want to raise money from the public, if you're a business owner and you think that you need more capital, the bank won't give it to you, and so you're thinking about going to the public, my goodness, you need Bob. You need a lawyer who understands the industry.
You got to make sure someone who is across the T's and dot the I's.
Oh, that's right.
And actually, there have been some changes recently which have eased up the rules somewhat on small businesses that want to raise capital, not only in crowdfunding, but also the other mechanisms that small businesses can use to appeal to new investors. So it's kind of an exciting time for small business in that sense, in that there are probably better opportunities now to raise money from investors, or at least some of the roadblocks have been lowered. And in this time of somewhat tightened credit markets, that can be very important.
Well, angel investing seems to be a big thing nationwide. It's not such a huge thing in Atlanta, although it seems to be growing a bit. Do you see a lot of that with smaller companies that are trying to raise money from an angel investor?
Yeah, we see a lot of companies who want to raise money that way. Unfortunately, that industry has attracted probably more than its share of bad guys.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people out there who are in the purportedly in the angel investing business who are primarily in it to enrich themselves. They'll take fees up front from companies that really are desperate to raise capital.
Yeah.
And oftentimes the fee disappears and the angel disappears with the small business's money. So businesses have to be very careful about how they raise capital.
If there's listeners out there that want to be on the angel investing side, they want to actually be the investor that's bringing the big check, as it were, are there any particular things that they should do to be careful about fraud, maybe in the middleman section, or even on the company that's setting up a front?
Well, I would say the most important thing that someone who wants to be an investor or in the middle of an investment process needs to be aware of is the fact that you may very well inadvertently become a securities broker-dealer by doing that.
Right.
And you may need to register. As I said earlier, it's a minefield, and no matter what position you want to play in the investment industry, you need to be aware that there are probably some laws and regulations that apply to you, and you should make sure you know what those are, but make sure you know where the mines are before you set off across the field.
Right. Good stuff.
Guys, going back to that question about the back-end stuff, just to play a fun current event, what do you guys think about Facebook? Do you think there'll be backlash on that? Was there deception and fraud on the IPO there? I mean, we've got a stock that went up to $45 and has been as low as 18. I think it's, 18 and, 30-something right now? So, any opinion there?
Really overvalued it, but it's hard to make a case that somebody did something intentionally. Yeah, I mean, yeah. In that instance, you're looking for material, intentional misrepresentations or material omissions, and those offerings are scrubbed up and down. So I'd be surprised if there were any successful lawsuits on that, but boy, they certainly misplayed the market, didn't they?
Yeah.
And that's really what it seems like. It just seems like a bad play, more than anything else.
And as an investor, anything that people could have done to have been smarter about investing in that IPO, or did just luck of the draw and some people got burned and that's the market?
Well, I think the numbers were there as to what the price to earnings ratio was, and it's huge. I mean, you're paying how much for future earnings, and it's probably an unwise decision. But there's momentum and there's excitement about this new thing finally coming to market, and so people probably paid a little bit too much attention to their emotions.
Maybe it's that thing you said stuck in your brain. They remember, I missed out on Netscape or Yahoo.
That's
or whatever. Right. I'm going to get in on this one.
That's right.
Well, a lot of people have made a lot of money in IPOs over the years, but investing, by and large, should be a calm process, an orderly process. So it's important for investors to take a step back, pinch themselves, slap themselves even before they invest to make sure what they're doing is the rational thing to do.
Good stuff. Great, great stuff. So, Keith, tell us about the American Retirement Initiative that you're developing, the organization. What is it all about? And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about it.
One of the things that has become clear from every indicator you see is that Americans, by and large, are not ready to retire. We just aren't. So one of the things that we do is focus on what can we do to help employers, specifically the benefits people, the human resources advisors who advise people, the financial advisors, the legal advisors, the TPAs, help people retire better. How can we arm people with better information so that they can make better decisions? So the American Retirement Initiative really focuses on that. We do it in a few ways. One way is that we have summits. We have big summits. We have a lot of thought leaders who attend summits, high-level government officials, corporate CEOs, both from the financial sector and the nonprofit sector. One of our big partners, for example, is not in the financial sector at all. It would be Scripps Network Interactive. They do, you know, the Food Channel and HGTV or whatever, and they're just particularly committed to the retirement savings issue. What we do is we have the summits. They're actually videotaped. So if you go to the website, AmericanRetirementInitiative.org, and click on, you can actually see the summit, see footages, or footage, singular, of the summit and see what people are talking about specific issues. We talked about diminished capacity earlier, retiree health savings, which is a huge issue, suitability, fiduciary responsibility, a laundry list, what the financial industry can better do to help people plan for retirement. So we do that. We have newsletters that focus on specific issues, and those go out to thousands of financial advisors and human resources advisors, et cetera. And then the website, which has latest news and information about financial services issues, and then research. Lots of companies are really doing a lot of great research, so we showcase the research that's already done. We don't originate research, but we do showcase all the good research that's out there. We don't lobby. I've done that before. I spent a career doing that. Don't do it now, but work with a lot of organizations and trade groups that do. There's a lot of expertise out there. There are a lot of people that know a lot. It is never our goal to reinvent the wheel, but what we do like to do is harness the information that's out there, concentrate it in a place where people can take advantage of it.
Good. Beautiful. So just as kind of a wrap-up question, we always like to ask our guests for their pearl of wisdom. So, Bob, I'm going to put you on the hot spot first. What would your pearl of wisdom be for our listeners?
Well, there are many pearls in the ocean, but the one that I would mention now is if you're investing, deal with a professional. Do not invest your life savings or even a part of it with someone who is operating out of their trunk or their you don't know where they're operating
right,
out of.
Right.
And check up on the professional. Just because you're dealing with a professional doesn't mean you can assume anything, so you have to be very careful. But dealing with a professional is probably the place I would start.
Okay. Pat?
I would say folks need to learn more about how a healthy human brain processes information in the investment context, because we are wired in a certain way, and it has huge implications for the decisions that you make in the investment context, and most of those go on behind the curtain of your conscious thought. So what I tell people is learn a little bit more about those cognitive biases we talked about before. You'll be much better able to make smart decisions.
And Bob and Pat, do you guys have contact information that you could give our listeners if they ever wanted to reach out to you, emails or a website?
Yes, the website is pageperry.com, and that's page like the page of a book, and Perry like P as in Paul, E-R-R-Y. .com, and our telephone number is 770-673-0047.
And if folks want to follow the Investors Watch blog, just type that in investors, plural, watchblog.com.
Okay, perfect. Keith, what's your pearl of wisdom?
I don't know if it's a pearl.
Half a pearl, a piece of a pearl.
Most people don't really start thinking about retirement until they're about 52. One of the things you hear all the time for folks, from people, but it was absolutely essential, is you really need to start focusing on retirement immediately after college. The reality that the world that our children live in will be very, very different. They'll work at lots of different places with portable retirement plans, and they're going to have to take a lot more of an active role. And it's best to begin with your first job when you're 22 or 23, or even if you work while you're in college, planning. I think that's the single most important thing that I could say.
And contact information, Keith, for you?
AmericanRetirementInitiative.org or kgreen@AmericanRetirementInitiative.org.
Okay. Well, thank you guys for your time. We appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And to our listeners, we certainly appreciate you taking the time to spend with us this morning. Until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.